It's Friday, and that means another edition of our weekly podcast where Jeremy, my son and partner, and I take a look at the relevant issues of the day, real and unscripted. That's our Zogby Report, subtitled The United States of Democracy. We've got a big week, a lot of events going on, and we're going to address those. But we're going to do today's show in three separate segments. First of all, as promised, I'm going to take a look at another in a series of key Senate races. This is the fourth one that's rated as a toss-up. We're going to look at Arizona. And then secondly, Jeremy and I are going to talk about Russia and Ukraine and the implications that maybe from two different points of view, we'll see. And then thirdly, we have a guest, Craig Shirley, who I'll be introducing in a little bit, who has written a book called April 1945 about the closing months of World War II and all the events that take place just during that month alone. And it has an enormous amount of implications for what we're seeing in the Russia-Ukraine relationship. It's a good interview. And so, Jer, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm doing well. So we've looked so far in terms of the U.S. Senate. We looked at Pennsylvania. Of course, we'll update these as we go along. Mm-hmm. We took a brief look at Wisconsin. And then Georgia was last week. Our number four in terms of the hot races is Arizona. Arizona, this is one of two seats that were elected. In 2020, this was a special seat with the 2 years remaining a term of Jeff Flake. And it was won by the Democrat, Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly, of course, a famous astronaut, twin brother who is an astronaut. These twins on separate occasions have been on the U.S. Space Station, or no, the International Space Station. Mark Kelly also married to former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, as we all know, who suffered a debilitating brain injury when she was shot doing her job as a congresswoman. It was a very close race in Arizona. Arizona is important. It's a large state. It's a growing state, and it is a purple state. Burgeoning blue. Traditionally, it was all Republican all the time, and now it is clearly a swing state. So he's got to now, Mark Kelly, run for his own full term of 6 years. The Republicans are not sure yet who their nominee is going to be. But suffice it to say that State Attorney General, who is Mark Brnovich, Blake Masters, who is a wealthy businessman, and then several other candidates are all vying to be Trump Republicans, which is kind of interesting. The state Republican Party is very conservative, and the question is whether it's too conservative for the more prototypical independent, even moderate Republican that you see a lot of, not only among Republicans, but among independents as well. Masters, Brnovich on the Republican side have each raised an enormous amount of money, only to be surpassed by Mark Kelly, who just in the last quarter alone raised almost $10 million. He far surpasses any of the potential Republican opponents. But I looked at this race. I looked at Kelly's victory over Martha McSally, former military person, who he defeated just barely in 2020. This is what I found. The two largest counties in the state, first of all, Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, has about 4.7 million. That's the fastest growing county in the United States. Kelly won that county over McSally 53-47. The second largest county is Pima, southeastern corner that includes Tucson. It's only about 15% of the vote. Kelly won that 60-40% over McSally, and then he got trounced in the rest of the state. If he's going to win, watch the Phoenix area and the Tucson area, needless to say. What put Kelly over the top was the fact that 16% of the total vote were 18-29-year-olds. That's high for a Senate race, but he benefited from the fact that 2020 was a presidential year. And that 16% of the total is more typical of a presidential year. This is now 2022. If Kelly does not bring out 18-29-year-olds, hard to see him win this race. Incidentally, he won among 18-29-year-olds by two-thirds to one-third over McSally. Kelly got 97% support among Democrats. This is a McSally only got 89% of Republicans. That's a difference. And Kelly won handily among independents. The two tied among men and women. But the key here is that Latinos are one-fifth of the total electorate. And Kelly won the Latino vote 65-35. I'm going to end the conversation right here. These are the questions. Can Kelly get young people out to vote? Can he get Latinos out to vote? And are the changes that you and I and others are seeing among Latinos kind of a tilt more in a conservative direction among some that may vote Republican? Is that going to happen in Arizona as well? Those are the two critical votes to look for, as well as Maricopa and Pima counties, in other words, Phoenix and Tucson. Any reaction to that brief summary?
No, I'm going to say you have the final word on that, because that was in depth. And I agree with all of that. Of course, my mind right now is probably like yours is across the Atlantic in Eastern Europe right now. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to go into that, trying to figure out what's going on.
And yeah, take a lead.
I'll go back to a really interesting thing that I learned in graduate school in history. A history professor said that at the conclusion of a war, typically are the seeds planted for the future war. And so If we look at Ukraine, we try to think, what was the conclusion of a major previous war where seeds might be sprouting? Of course, and this fits into Mr. Shirley, our next guest. But of course, we have to talk about Yalta, right? World War II essentially commenced or ended with Yalta, and that is Eastern Ukraine. And so here we are, and those seeds are starting to sprout. And they've been sprouting for quite a while. This is nothing new. Remember, the situation in Ukraine has been going on for 8 years. So if you look at the news, what is absolutely fascinating is for the first time in maybe 6 years or maybe even more, if you turn on CNN or if you turn on Fox, the headlines are similar. And the narrative of what's going on in Ukraine is uniform. In other words, liberals and conservatives and Democrats and Republicans, by and large, agree in the current narrative as that Putin is entirely the bad guy, and that the United States has a humanitarian duty to go in and save the poor Ukrainians. But I think somebody has to point out the fact that the United States has a pretty awful track record when it comes into getting involved in humanitarian wars, and the last decade show it. Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, Libya, and beyond, of course, Syria. But, you know, it's not so much the narrative, I think, that people should focus on, that the United States needs to do something with this humanitarian crisis. I think there are three things that really give a different point of view that's being lost in the Western media. And to keep it simple, I call it the three N's. It's mm-hmm. natural gas. It's mm-hmm. what I'm calling NATO Stan and, mm-hmm. and neo-Nazis. So let's begin with the first one. We have to ask the question, why are Western governments, and why have they over the last 8 years been in support of parties that have neo-Nazi sympathies in Kiev and supporting them and that group's efforts towards bombing Eastern Ukraine over the last 8 years? That's number one. What interest do we have in that? Number two, what does natural gas play in all of this? Of course, Russia has Nord Stream, and through Ukraine, they supply Europe, and that is leverage that they have over Europe. And the idea is, if you can get Ukraine out of the Russian sphere of influence, there are massive oil and natural gas reserves in the breakaway regions, Luhansk and Donetsk. And there's a third region, Donbas, which are separatists. So that is a major focus of what's going on, is that if Ukraine, especially in the eastern province, can fall under the influence of the West, you cut out the Russian influence of energy. And then last but not least is the notion of NATO Stan. We're familiar with Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all those countries south of the Russian border. But what essentially has happened since the fall of the Soviet Union has been what we could call the creation of NATO Stan. The Baltic nations, Poland, many Eastern European countries that were previously in the sphere of Russian influence have gone into the European Union and have gone into NATO. And there are really only a few countries left that Russia has in its sphere of influence. Belarus, Ukraine is could go either way, and maybe Moldova and maybe a couple other countries. But you have the systematic buildup of NATO bases and military bases. And so when you look at it through the three ends of natural gas, neo-Nazis, and NATO Stan, you begin to understand the Russian perspective. And so I don't, you know, I'm not going to say, and we talked about before, that whether there's a good guy or a bad guy, we're trying to understand this through self-interest. But what's lost in the Western media is that perception that the Russians have of an aggressive relationship between Western governments to pull Ukraine into its sphere away from Russia's. And the most important question is, who has more to lose? Does the United States have more to lose, or does Russia have more to lose? And I think that's being completely lost in all of this.
Okay, there's a lot here. You know, my history professor in graduate school said, do not look at foreign affairs and wars as good guys versus bad guys. You and I have talked about that many times. And I agree with you. It is appropriate to talk about Yalta, because at Yalta, a deal was struck. Roosevelt and Churchill on one hand, Stalin on the other. Stalin's principle was, whoever liberates an area shall occupy that area. And pure and simple. So Stalin said, okay, you guys liberated France and Italy and Greece. That's your territory. Meanwhile, I liberated Poland and Ukraine and the Balkans. That's my area. And Stalin, of course, everybody went into this war with self-interest for their nation. But Stalin's point was the same point that the Tsars had mentioned, that Frederick Barbarossa had mentioned, which is, hey, we always get attacked from the West. We need a buffer zone. And understood, Stalin is an awful person. Look, so is Vladimir Putin, an awful person. But in the meantime, while that served Russian interests to have that buffer zone, we're talking about real people that did not want to be a buffer zone that wanted their own independence and their own whatever you call definition of democracy. Obviously, you see it passionately throughout Eastern Europe, Central Europe, notably the Czech Republic, where you spent time, the Polish, to be sure. So let's just not forget that in the midst of this argument that that Vladimir Putin made to the Russian people more than to anyone else to stir up their drive for taking back the Ukraine, which he said that Lenin actually created, that we're talking about real people, in Kyiv, real people throughout the country who don't want this and are suffering. As you and I are speaking right now on Friday morning, there are hundreds of soldiers that are dead already, hundreds of civilians dead already. And my understanding, without any great details yet, is that a cruise missile or two were fired in Ukraine overnight. I don't have any details on that. So, I mean, how do we deal with that? I don't believe there's anything the United States can do to stop Vladimir Putin. Maybe he can stop himself. But what do we tell our friends in NATO who are in Lithuania and Estonia, Latvia? On a good day, they're frightened of a Russian in days. This gives them a lot to be worried about. What do we tell them? You're screwed?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, the United States made the promise not to go an inch length into what was the former satellite Soviet bloc nations. And we've broken that promise, I don't know, maybe a dozen times. So when you're talking about a couple countries left of the Russian sphere of influence, we have to be absolutely careful in projecting an image that the United States has any humanitarian interest in this. The United States does not have any humanitarian interest in it. I know that's the hook right now, because like I said, you have Democrats and Republicans talking alike, saying we need to help the Ukrainians. But the fundamental question that's being ignored is, who has more to lose? Can Washington, D.C. go before European people and say, we stand to lose more than you do or than Russia does? They can't say that. And so therefore, they've got a comfortable buildup of NATO countries. I don't think Putin has any intention, once he has Ukraine back in his sphere of influence, I don't think he has any intention of bringing back the Soviet Empire, and splitting Berlin halfway through and splitting Germany in half. I really don't think so. I think it's, like you said, in creating that buffer. But remember, I mean, we could go back and forth, but there was a coup in 2014, and one has to really look into what elements funded that coup and brought in a pro-Western government and kicked out a pro-Russian government. It's essentially D.C. has been meddling into the affairs, and I don't think they should be meddling into the affairs. They've been doing it for 8 years. Something we'll have to give.
Just as a final note from me, let's not lose track of, I'm a Lebanese American, and obviously I care very deeply about what's going on in Lebanon. There are a couple of million Ukrainian Americans. There are several million Polish Americans. There are people who have family and homes back in these countries, and they care very deeply. So this is a humanitarian crisis. And of course, just to bring it to our doorstep, Utica, which is near where we live, is a haven for refugees. And we just got new groups of Afghans here in this small city. And we can be sure to be getting another a group of Ukrainians as yeah. well.
Yeah, so and I have to say another thing because I taught refugees and I saw these waves come in because of needless wars. Libya was a disaster led by Washington, D.C. Syria has been a disaster led by Washington, D.C. Ukraine has been a disaster. These humanitarian crises aren't new. They've been going on for several years. I have a strong suspicion that had we not gotten involved in those conflicts, that they probably wouldn't have happened. You have to ask where it precipitates from. So yes, there are humanitarian crises, but you can't blame it and make it a one-sided narrative that it's coming from Moscow only.
Okay, we're going to get a perspective from the author and colleague of ours and friend Craig Shirley when we talk to him in a moment. I'm very pleased now to welcome our guest, a good friend, a colleague, someone that I've worked with a number of times over the last couple of decades, Craig Shirley, author, historian, consultant, founder of Shirley Bannister, and now Shirley McVicker, one of the real power public relations outfits in the Washington, D.C. area, and a man who has gone back to his first love, I guess you'd say, as an historian. He's written a number of books, four on Ronald Reagan alone, a bestseller called December 1941, and now this one, brand new, coming out, and we'll be showing on the screen the cover of the book. It's called April 1945, The Hinge of History. Welcome, Craig. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, John, very, very much. I've been looking forward to this. Thank you.
So, you know, we all think that when at the moment we live, this is the worst year. This is the most eventful year.
Yeah.
This is a year like no other year. But 1945 really fit that description.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mention that. It's funny you mention that, John, because Zarina and I were in the car yesterday, actually going down to Los Angeles to for a private screening of a rough cut of a movie. We were listening to Bloomberg Radio, and I heard a broadcaster say, talking about Ukraine, he said, well, this is the worst catastrophe since World War II. And Zarina and I looked at each other and said, what the hell are you talking about? You know, the worst, I mean, this is minuscule compared to 9/11, compared to Korea, compared to the Cold War, compared to, I can name a dozen other monument, really earth-shattering events. This is not earth-shattering. This is a minor thing that I smell wag the dog here. Now there's talk about delaying the State of the Union. Come on, really. Let's put this in context, okay? A tin horn dictator is grabbing a little land for himself. Okay, it's tragic for those people, but this is European. This is a European concern, not an American concern. When he threatens America, wake me up and tell me. But otherwise, we should be projecting American power to defend American interests. I'm sorry, I'm editorializing here my own opinion. I beg your pardon.
Oh, you're entitled to your own opinion. This is the United States.
Yeah.
Craig, well, give us that context. You know, just kind of quickly walk us through 1945 and then zero in on just the month alone. But walk us through 1945, the entire year.
Yeah, it was the war was winding down. We were winning, although the Germans were still, you know, the Battle of the Bulge took place starting in December and continued through to January, February, March, and April, although it was faltering. It was the last German offensive before Patton's Third Army and the Russian Army overwhelmed the German Army and marched into Berlin. We're obviously winning in the Pacific, but we hadn't finished the war yet. And although the A-bomb was being developed, it was still the Trinity hadn't exploded. And MacArthur was planning. One of the things happening in April 1945 was the battle for Okinawa was raging. Mm-hmm. And of course, Okinawa was going to be the staging island for the final invasion, planned invasion of Japan before the development of the A-bomb and dropping on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So MacArthur's forces were fighting to win Okinawa. And by the way, it's in the book too. Okinawa was a nasty little island. It had, mm-hmm. had biting snakes, and it had biting insects, and it had malaria, and there was nothing appealing about the island of Okinawa, except that we wanted it to use it to prepare for the invasion of Japan. What's going on? The national speed limit was 35 miles an hour. Can you imagine driving in Wyoming at 35 miles an hour? or even on upstate, from Buffalo to Albany or something, driving 35 miles an hour. Food rationing was going on. There were scrap drives, metal drives, rubber drives, paper drives. Americans, it was the last time there was really national unity for any duration in this country. But, you know, it's funny because people get upset when I say, well, there's no national unity, but there's no national unity now on Ukraine. It said more than half the American people are opposed to our sending troops to Ukraine. This country was defined by its division. It was all about compromise.
Let me
just finish this at one point.
Yeah, sure.
Is that April of 45 was the only time, or actually the war years were really the only time this country has been unified for any duration of time. Otherwise, we've always been divided.
And then in the midst of all of this going on that you've depicted, all of a sudden we have a new president of the United States.
Yes,
who only spoke to Roosevelt once as vice president of the United States.
Yes.
And now Powell, Harry Truman, who is this guy? Who is this guy?
He's a product of the Pendergast machine in Missouri. There was some questions about the dubious ballots that he received for a voter for the U.S. Senate. But nonetheless, he was in charge of the commission investigating contracts and misappropriation of funds during the war years, and he did a very good job at that. Probably too good of a job because he got too close to embarrassing some people around FDR, which may have been one reason he chose him. But it was convenient too because Henry Wallace, who was FDR's second vice president after John Nance Garter, had become such an embarrassment to the Roosevelt administration because he was such a collectivist and was anti-war and various things. It had a jettison. And he needed a moderate conservative, and Harry Truman filled the bill to balance the ticket. And they won in another landslide in 44, setting up Truman to replace FDR, who tragically died in April of 1945, at only the age of 63. That's why April 45 is the hinge of history, why it's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. FDR dies, Hitler commits suicide, Mussolini is taken down by the mob, Auschwitz is discovered, Dachau is discovered, the war for Okinawa is going on, we're developing the A-bomb, there's national rationing. 25% of all vegetables grown in America are grown in Victory Garden. We were sending the rest to the American GI, to the British GI, and to the Soviet Army. They were getting all of our material, all of our foodstuffs and war material. So Detroit had been turned into an arsenal of democracy. A new car hadn't been built in Detroit in years, since December 7th, 1941. It was just churning out planes, jeeps, and tanks. The whole country changed.
And at the same time that we're heading towards victory. Victory is won on the Eastern Front, and Stalin has turned around the Soviets, and they're racing towards Berlin.
Yes.
And during this month, we've got a race. Who's going to get to Berlin first?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, because there was so much at stake. It was not only control of Berlin, but control of the politics, control of the future, control of the technology. We were in a mad race with the Soviets, as an example, to get their V-1 and V-2 rocket programs. We both wanted to develop planetary capabilities, or at least orbital launching capabilities. And so we were in a mad race to get von Braun and to get his technology and to get his stripped down V-1s and V-2s and send them back to either Soviet Union or the United States. Fortunately, we won. And we got the bulk of the Russian rocket program. That's just one example.
And then as another example, and then all of a sudden there's a meeting at Potsdam among the big three, and there's a new one of those big three that Stalin and Churchill don't know anything about, let alone the American people.
Yes, that's right.
Pivotal
time. And Truman said about Potsdam, Truman said that Stalin was a pain in the ass. Even before that was Yalta, where the big three met. And I always wondered why, if FDR was in essence the president of the world, he was he was running a two front war. He was supplying our allies. He had his sons in combat. He had a very admirable wife, but who was also outspoken. He had 1,000 things on his plate, and now he's got to fly 11,000 miles to Yalta to go to a crappy, rundown former Tsar resort, which had bad food, bad bedding, bad, it was cold. It was everything. And why he doesn't make Stalin come to him, I have no idea. I've researched this, and I can find no evidence why they all had to go to Yalta instead of Churchill and Stalin coming to, say, Miami Beach,
So, let me ask you this, before we get into the obvious question about Putin today and the relevance of 1945 to this. I have polled on Americans' views of the greatest presidents since FDR. And what I've discovered, Ronald Reagan notwithstanding, conservatives love Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes, they do.
And they rank him highly. And, in focus groups, when you ask who was a truly great president, even conservatives say Franklin Roosevelt.
Absolutely.
Why? Counterintuitive to the layman. Why? Why is he viewed so great?
Because, during the Great Depression, he gave Americans hope. And that's really a very important role for the bully pulpit, is to give hope. He didn't solve unemployment. It was still as bad in early 1941 as it had been in 1933. But at least he gave the Americans, America was a vastly different country. We were at least hopeful. The second was his conduct of the war. And what was so brilliant about it was he surrounded himself with really capable military men like Patton, like Eisenhower, like Marshall, like King, like Nimitz, like MacArthur, like so many others. And then he stood back and really didn't interfere. He let them conduct the war as they saw fit. He gave them armaments, he gave them men, he gave them morale, he gave them advice, certainly not unsolicited. He gave them direction or a suggested direction, but it was really the perfect way to be a manager, whether you're running a big company or you're running a big war or big wars, is to surround yourself with very good people and let them do their jobs.
So April of 1945, we're both sides, that's the Soviets and the Americans, are racing to get to Berlin. Really, if you want to ring a bell and say this is the official start of the Cold War, because we had been allies, of course.
Yes.
So what are the implications? What are the implications today? Because obviously, Vladimir Putin the other day made a huge argument to the Russian people as to all of the hurts that have taken place since the fall of the Soviet Empire, blah, blah, blah. But perhaps worked with the Russian people, or it didn't stop him from doing what he's doing. What are the implications of your book that people need to know to understand what happened this week?
Well, you said that about Putin, and one thing's for certain is that you can't be a Russian without having a chip on your shoulder. You just naturally feel like the world is against you. They always have. Even during the Soviet Union, they always have. Second of all, the implications are, the closest is this reminds me of Hitler and the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia, taking it, claiming that it was more German in culture than it was Czechoslovakia. Let's face it, Czechoslovakia was a mashed together country after World War I between Slovakia and the Czech Republic. And it's gone back now to its natural borders and natural culture. But it reminds me of Hitler. Second thing is that and Putin taking chunks of Ukraine, claiming they're more Russian than they are Ukraine. And Ukraine again is a kind of a mashed together country that was created after World War I. But it has a distinct culture. There's no doubt about it. And very agrarian. Deep, no pun intended, deep roots and agrarian exports, things like that. But is that, first of all, Putin is no Hitler. Putin is no threat to the United States. Hitler was evil. Hitler was dangerous. Hitler was a threat to the United States. Hitler was a threat to the world. It created camps for the manufacturing of the destruction of human beings based on their race or based on their political opposition. He killed 20 million people as best we know, but 10 million people died in the camps. It's interesting, John, is I once looked at a map of Western Europe, a map of all the death camps. And there wasn't just the ones that you and I know about, like Treblinka or Auschwitz or Dachau. There were dozens of them. There were dozens of camps for the murder of human beings. And it was such a priority that Hitler, he actually put more resources into the SS and the killing of people than he did into the regular army and winning the war. It was such a priority for him.
Well, Craig, our time is coming to a close here. But so where do we go from here? You are at the Reagan Library right now as we speak.
Yes.
And you're off to a number of presidential libraries, yes. Holocaust museums. So this book tour is a big deal. How do we get this book? I ordered it on Amazon. So
yeah, sure. Yeah, John, that's wonderful. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, on any place online that sells books, any independent bookstores. It's in big box stores. I know it's in Costco. The publisher scored that in Costco. So it's pretty much everywhere. So thank you very much for that.
Well, you are a good friend and colleague, as I introduced you. And I'm very happy that you found the time at 6:30 in the morning to spend a little
time. I was looking forward to this, John. Thank you so much.
Anytime. Craig, take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
You too, John. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we promised you lively discussions, and there is an awful lot going on in the world today, all of which we tried to cover comprehensively. Stay tuned. There'll obviously be more on these and other topics next week. Bye-bye.
Have a good weekend.